The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading and rating. We really appreciate it. If you know someone who loves science, let them know about our podcast. Coming up on this week's programme, one of those brilliant topics we love to revisit over and over, the fantastic Sean Carroll has a new book out in which he posits that the many worlds theory is actually the universe in which we inhabit. In other words, there's an infinite number of you, an infinite number of me, and an infinite number of variables, just like Gwyneth Paltrow's sliding doors. We'll be getting deep into the science in a few minutes' time, but first, it's time to look back at the week's headlines, and joining me in studio is Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
Is this, as some people have suggested, something of an act of defiance given what's been going on? Look at the clock. 1:54.99. It's just outside the time of Paris last year, but it's very, very quick indeed. They say that actions are much better than words, and I think Caster Semenya exemplifies that perfectly.
Is to do with testosterone in women's sports, and particularly in women athletes, Ruth.
Yes, that's right. So for many years, it's been assumed that testosterone was essentially a performance enhancer, and it was one of the reasons why male athletes perform better. But this is the first study to actually look at the effect of testosterone in women. So it's a Swedish study. It's a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial. The researchers looked at 48 women between 18 and 35, and they essentially gave half of that group testosterone over a 10-week period. And then they looked at their performance.
Wow.
At the end of that period. You okay. Say wow because it's surprising that they got ethical approval to do that.
Yes. That blows my mind because testosterone obviously doesn't just help you run faster. It makes you more hirsute, I believe.
It's a surprising one. And I think it is one of the reasons why this research hasn't happened to date. The lead researcher is actually a member of the Swedish Olympic Council. She's their gynecologist. So clearly this is why, you know, they wanted to do this work to look at the sporting element of it. And it is obviously on the back of some pretty controversial rulings by the International Athletics Federation, which, you know, is relevant to the clip you just played.
Yeah, that was Caster Semenya, obviously winning a race where testosterone levels were very much in question as to whether or not Caster was a valid sports person.
Yeah.
So what did the study find?
So what the study found was after the 10 weeks, the testosterone levels in the women had gone up about four times. So they were at about 4 nanomoles per litre, which is still much lower than you would find in men.
You say four times, do you mean four times what a woman would have?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Fourfold,
exactly. But still much lower than you would find in most men. So it was about four nanomoles per litre. In men, the range can be kind of from 7 to maybe 30. So still way below that. But what they found was about an 8.5% improvement in their ability to run at endurance. So they could stay on a treadmill to fatigue for about 20 seconds longer.
From testosterone alone?
Yeah, and they also found that they had gained more lean muscle mass. So they had gained over 900 grams of lean muscle mass compared to just over 100 grams in the other group. So what they have concluded from this is testosterone is a factor in terms of looking at this athletic performance. So this
and
is
that
the
wasn't
first
known before then. Was
there, was no scientific research that really showed it. There was a study that was withdrawn, which looked at the percentage of women with very high testosterone that seemed to be in the winning categories of races, but that wasn't validated and it was drawn. So this is the first study looking at testosterone in women.
So this is a substance that we can synthesize, or how do you administer testosterone?
Yeah, well, it's like a lot of hormone treatments, like estrogen treatments or birth control treatments. We can synthesize these hormones, and this was applied in a cream that the women put on every day. But obviously, we do have people who produce testosterone naturally as well, and we see a range of that in both men and women.
Yeah, and I suppose the reason this study is done begs a question, because really this is not about it's not about biology. It's about social construct of what a man and a woman is, right?
Exactly. I mean, we have a system of sport which is essentially binary in a world that isn't binary. And that's where these challenges arise. So what the International Athletics Federation want to do is to make sure that all competitors in female sports have testosterone levels of less than 5 nanomoles per litre. But of course, that doesn't take into account all of the other impacts of testosterone or growing up with testosterone, or for trans athletes who may have had high levels of testosterone while they were growing up but now have low levels of testosterone. So it's incredibly complicated. And I think what the science is telling us is exactly that. I mean, the testosterone pathway impacts on over 6,000 genes in our body. And for all of these different people who have different levels, it's probably had a different impact over their whole life. So to take one thing away, you know, it's a rather unusual stance. I mean, we've seen other athletes, for example, who have very, very high levels of red blood cells. You know, there was some famous examples of people who had sort of 20% above the normal amount of EPO, which, of course, is a famous doping substance.
Yeah.
So all of this variation is actually normal.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at you know, longer legs, bigger feet,
exactly.
Michael Phelps.
Yeah. I mean,
this is a variation of biology, but because it's associated with gender, it seems that we're asking these questions because we only want ladylike women to take part mm-hmm. in sports, which just seems so completely ridiculous. And this is the sort of thing that makes you say, science is ethical, that science and culture are inseparable. The fact that we're asking this question of science in the first place mm-hmm. is a dodgy one in my reading of it.
I mean, I'm not sure this study tells us an awful lot. You know, the women in this study possibly don't have, I mean, they don't have the same biological background as the athletes that we're talking about. They have their own unique background. So while on average, this is what's happening with these 48 women, with people that potentially have different chromosome compositions and were brought up in different ways, it may not be the same. And in fact, Caster Semenya is interesting because I looked at her records, and in fact, her fastest time over 800 metres doesn't even beat the women's 800 metre world record. She's not the world record holder.
Yeah.
And she's way off the male world record holder. So there's clearly many, many factors at play, as you said.
No,
and some of them aren't even, you know, there's environmental factors as well.
Exactly. And if the idea that, you know, that this was just the one thing that made a difference, then you would have, you know, trans yeah. people winning races all
exactly.
over the place. You'd
yeah.
have, you know, women with high testosterone. Yeah. It's not the only
And we're
thing.
Not looking at the male competitors and saying, well, you have a 30 nanomoles per litre and you only have 7. So that's not a level playing field.
Or are we saying you don't have enough testosterone to compete in the men's,
no.
which sounds absolutely ridiculous, but yeah. it is the reverse argument.
Yeah. But like from an educational point of view, there's this stance that we're all started equal, and that we're like, you know, if you have loads of money, if you've done loads of well, it's because you've worked hard. That's a lot of rubbish.
Yeah.
Like, we all have huge advantages and privileges, and we just need to recognise them.
We're going to get loads of texts in, as we do, weirdly, on how right on we are. And it's like, you're so for equality and fairness. And
yeah.
But I know, but like, it's weird. We get a lot of those emails in, people saying, you know, you seem to just want the world to be a great equal place. Well,
yeah.
I don't. Yours sincerely, John P. Grumpy.
I get letters from him.
Our second story has to do with biodiversity, and this sort of seems kind of obvious when you think about everything we
yeah,
know.
It's another equality story. So it's about not having monocultures when it comes to growing crops. And this is a study that was published this week in Science. It has authors from right around the world. Scientists, probably all ecologists, who studied what's happening in 1,500 fields, and they looked particularly at pollinating insects. They looked at the service they provide, and they also looked at other insects that provide a natural sort of pest control. So these two factors, the pollinators and the pest control people, or insects, not people. And they found that in very biodiverse biosystems, that the yield was higher. And like, I suppose that might be a little counterintuitive, because we live in a world where we spray with pesticides and try to control everything and reduce the biodiversity to increase yield.
Yeah, you were talking about a field of wheat that is rows and rows of wheat, nothing else,
no hedgerows,
no biodiversity whatsoever. So that when you thresh it, it's pure, clean wheat you don't have to worry about.
Yeah.
And
all the service insects as well that would come into that biosphere and would do their work. And so, like, if you start spraying for things, you're going to start killing a lot of those. And so their service is removed, and you need to add more sort of man-made or artificial ways in to get your plants to grow. And they showed that when you have more biodiversity, you have more pollinators and you have more natural pest control. so that, this is the crazy outcome here, it means if a farmer actually works on creating a system where there's a lot more biodiversity, more trees, more variety of trees, more hedges, lots of insects and different types of crops, then that will provide enough help to increase the farmer's yield so they don't need the pesticides.
The question, though, is if you get a completely biodiverse field, it's not very easy to farm, right? The great thing about monocultures is it's very easy to farm. If you have lots of different crops all over the place, well, it's certainly easy to harvest.
Well, yeah, but you have to actually spend time and money spraying out all those pesticides. And then, of course, you probably reduce the amount of money you can get for your crop because it isn't quote unquote organic. The yield will be, that this study shows, will be higher, right? And this is always something that's thrown at the organic movement, is you're not going to be able to make enough food, that it's a more middle class way of farming. But what this study is showing is that is not necessarily true. It's also worth noting that there was Irish research involved in this as well. So there was a lady from UCD, Dara Stanley, who's an ecologist out there, and she was looking at pollinators in oilseed rape fields, so that this sort of work can apply to farms in Ireland. And what it might mean is having hedgerows, having borders around your crop fields where the insect life can live and then can come out and do their work in your field. They're farmers that will help you.
Love to know what you make of that, particularly if you work in agriculture, if you're a farmer. Does this sound like pie in the sky stuff, or is it workable
like a huge amount of scientific research in Ireland is in the area of food, and Chagas can indeed, Roots organization SFI would fund and do numerous studies in this area. Ireland is not this idyllic place where we farm like we farmed in the 19th century. There's a lot of science involved in that, and most farmers know that.
Yeah. Ruth, our third story has to do with a new exhibit in a zoo that you may not expect.
Yes, and it's kind of an equality story, I'm afraid, to stick to our theme. It's equality.
It's not an equality story.
Well, it kind of is, because it's about
it
proper
now.
Billing for a yellow blob of goo. The blob, as it's been named, is going on show in a Paris zoo. And the reason why this has made the science headlines is because this is the first time we've had such an organism in a zoo for people to come along and see. And if you can imagine, it's kind of like that slime that kids play with. Imagine it's bright yellow in kind of a thin layer wrapped around a rotting log, but it kind of has veins running through it, and it can move at more than an inch in an hour. So you can actually visibly see it moving. And what this is in fact a slime mold, which is this incredible creature which scientists actually don't really understand. It doesn't fit into the animal kingdom. It's not a fungus, and it has all sorts of interesting properties that people in Paris or anyone who visits are now going to go and get to see it in the zoo.
It looks sort of like a precursor, like act one of an alien film.
Yes.
You know, it's like when you first come in contact, it's just a bit of moving cells that move differently. Look at under the microscope and you go, there's something weird happening here. And by act three, everyone's dying.
Exactly. And this mold, hopefully it won't take over the zoo. But what we do know it can do is we know it can learn. So we know that it can actually learn how to avoid dangerous substances. And in fact, if you cut it in half, it can grow back together again. If you it can actually pass on what it's learned to other slime molds. So if a slime mold knows how to avoid dangerous substances and it merges with another slime mold, the whole organism merges what the two slime molds knew.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, and if you were to film this thing, although it's a slime mold, as you say, if you were to film this thing and put it in hyperlapse, like, it will. It is unnerving to see these things move, because it's very undoubtedly a living, moving organism that looks like slime.
I wonder how it moves.
And it has 720 sexes, just to hark back to our first story and talking about the simplicity around sex or not.
Our final story, Shane, has to do with speedy ants.
Yes, and it is unspecified in this paper if any of the ants have testosterone levels that were measured. So this is not an equality story.
Yay!
This is about the best, right? Yes. This is about like the best ant that's out there. It is Saharan silver ant. And Basically, they've discovered that this thing moves at an incredible pace. It's able to move at a velocity, at a speed of around a metre a second, which is pretty fast, right?
Compared to its body length, it's insane.
Now, so the headline caught me. It was like fastest moving creature. It's not. It's the fastest moving over its body length. So it can move 108 times its own body length in 1 second, which compares to a cheetah, which can move 23 times its body length in 1 second. So they're saying it's faster.
I think that's fair.
It's not faster.
But I think it is faster because...
No, it's not.
No, because you have to shrink. If you bring it up to the size of a cheetah, because you have to, it's the only way it's fair to compare.
No, that's like saying that your Mini is faster than your Mercedes because it's smaller.
Yeah.
No. It's just speed is distance over time.
Is distance over time. Okay, fair.
It's one of the first equations.
It is. It's equations 101. Don't you remember, Jonathan?
Producer Aidan is saying, stick with the physicists on this one. So,
But it's pretty quick.
So, yeah, if you try and film it up close, it's very difficult to do it. It's very, very fast.
It looks like a horse galloping. And incredibly, it's each little foot, if insects have feet, is on the ground for as little as 7 milliseconds. Which is incredible. So it's moving across
almost floating.
Yes, exactly. Well, no, it's not floating. No. It's
there's a technical term for floating. And this has only just been measured, the speed of it?
Yes, and I think what was incredible here, just like that famous footage of the horse galloping, was getting the camera in there in order to capture what's happening at a very local level. So high-speed cameras were required to capture this.
What's it called? The
Saharan Silver Ant. Coming to a zoo near you, maybe next to the blob.
Dr. Shane Berger from UCD. Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland. Thanks very much. Now, it seems bizarre to me that Goop Queen Gwyneth Paltrow was the woman who introduced me to one of the most cutting-edge quantum physics theories that exists today. But there you go. In the 1998 movie Sliding Doors, the public was exposed to this idea that there are many realities available to us and reality branches out in many different ways. And that indeed, there may be many worlds in which many versions of ourselves exist. This is called the many worlds theory. And it brings us to the idea that it's quite possible Sliding Doors could have been the most accurate representation of reality to ever hit the cinemas. One person who may subscribe to this outrageous claim is Sean Carroll. He is a physicist and author of Something Deeply Hidden. He joins me now. Welcome back, Sean. How are you?
Thanks, very good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to have you back again. So let's start with an easy question. What is reality?
Well, the technical answer is that reality is modeled by a vector evolving in Hilbert space according to the Schrodinger equation. But that's probably not the answer you're really looking for right now.
No. So how do we, I mean, like when we start to measure reality and existence and the formation of everything we know, how do we even start that quest?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's a back and forth, right? It's not an algorithm. When you do science, there's this feeling that there's a right answer out there and the job of science is simply to find it. But in the real world, we never know exactly what that right answer is. So we're constantly learning a little bit, inventing a theory that fits the little bit that we learn, updating on the basis of new things that we learn and so forth. And quantum mechanics, which is where this whole story of many worlds comes from, is a classic example of this because we're trying to start by understanding the behavior of atoms or electrons, subatomic particles, and we end up by completely changing our view of what reality really is.
Introduce me to the idea of a wave function, please.
Well, back in the day, let's say 1909 or thereabouts, we had invented this picture that everyone has seen of an atom, right? And the picture you have in mind is there's a little nucleus of the atom made of protons and neutrons, and then there's electrons orbiting around it. It looks like a little solar system, right? We've all seen the cartoon.
Yeah.
But people realized that can't be right, that there was something fundamentally wrong about that picture because those electrons circling around should give off radiation. They should give off light, lose energy, and spiral into the nucleus. And all atoms should collapse and all matter should be wildly unstable. So that's bad. So it was, there's some, again, some give and take, some back and forth, some ideas put back and forth. But ultimately, the idea was, think of the electron as a wave rather than as a particle. Instead of being a little dot that orbits around the center of the nucleus, the electron is spread out in sort of a cloud. And that's the easy part. So we could do that. The electron is a wave. The hard part is, when you look at it, when you measure the electron, it looks to us like a particle. So there, that was the origin of the fundamental weirdness of quantum mechanics. The thing, the idea that things look like particles when you observe them, but they act like waves when you're not observing them.
So talk me through this idea of many worlds and how the science supports it in your point of view, because some people don't support this as a model for the universe, but this is one you subscribe to. What is the many worlds theory?
Yeah, this is, it's a brilliant idea that was had by a graduate student, Hugh Everett, in the 1950s. So remember, the fundamental mystery of quantum mechanics is that things are wave-like when you're not looking at them, and then you observe them and they snap into place and look like a particle. And so what people came up with was this interpretation where there's an entirely different set of rules for how quantum systems evolve, depending on whether you're looking at them or not. And what Everett says is, what if we don't do that? What if we don't complicate things with different sets of rules? Let's just have the one rule we know works when you're not looking at something. Let's demystify looking at something and ask what the world would be like if that's really what happened. And the answer is, when you look at something, it's not that it suddenly snaps into one position or another, but that the universe divides into many different copies, one of which says you saw it here, another one of which says you saw it over there. So all of those possibilities that were in the initial wave become realized. And again, it's not something that Everett put in. He's just taking seriously what the equations were telling him all along.
So explain to me how this works in real life. There are multiple versions of me, or there is one existence of me, and as every second passes and I make different decisions, new versions of me pop into different versions of that world.
Yeah, you know, there are many versions of someone who used to be you.
Okay.
You have to sort of talk in this weird pretzel kind of language, because the English language just wasn't invented to describe quantum mechanics, right? We're trying to shoehorn deep mathematical and physical ideas into some antiquated vocabulary. But there's you right now, and according to the many worlds theory, you right now is constantly splitting into multiple copies. And those copies in different worlds are different people, even though they came from the same place. It's just like, you know, Everett's analogy was an amoeba that splits. An amoeba, there's one amoeba, okay, it splits in two. There's neither one or the other that is the follow-up, you know, the descendant of the original amoeba. They're both equally good. The only difference in many worlds is they can't talk to each other anymore. Those two amoebas are in different worlds. And of course, it's not just amoebas, it's people and everything else as well.
And so in this theory, there is another world in which my name is McRae Jonathan as opposed to Jonathan McRae, but everything else is the same. That must allow for infinite everythings, right? Where I don't exist, where a slug is the dominating, you know, species on the planet, or just a mix of just gray goo. Because if we think of, since the beginning of, you know, life on the planet, or even beyond the star, the formation of stars and dust, there must be a reality where planets don't explode, they do something else. And as a result, there is that infinite number of realities that don't even include life.
Well, there's a couple of things to say about that. One is, there are other realities where things are slightly different, but it's not you in those realities, okay? If there's another person whose name is different than you, but is otherwise exactly the same to you and in every way, that person is still not you. The you that is you is right here in this universe, not in any other ones. So you can't sort of take credit or blame for anything that the other people are doing. Huh. The other point is that, you know, the laws of physics still apply. So there's plenty of things that don't happen in these other universes. For example, electric charge. charge is conserved, right? You cannot take a negative electric charge and turn it into a positive electric charge. So there's no universe in which electrons are turning into protons. That's just something that would never happen in any of the universes. So there are still rules, even though many, many different things happen.
So where is this other slightly more handsome me?
There's no location. I mean, even if it would be possible to conceive of a slightly more handsome version of you, they're not actually physically located in space. This is, again, something that our intuition and language just isn't up to describing very well. The universes exist. They're parallel, if you like, in some sense, but it's better just to say they're simultaneously existent, but you can't say where they are. That's just not a concept. It's like saying, where's the number five?
But I'm here. I'm on planet Earth in the Milky Way. I exist in a physical space. So the other Jonathan must exist in another space. If we say that these physical things exist, then there must be a place that we could, if we had a big enough spaceship, fly to get there. No?
No. So, I mean, just think about what you just said. You exist in space in this universe. That's the point. Space is something that exists within each universe, not the universes existing within some big space.
Okay. So this then, I mean, I know the field is theoretical physics. Is this all just I have to be careful, actually, because in the scientific community, theory is very different. I don't want to confuse people. But this idea of many universes, by its very nature, cannot be proven because we can't in any way move or record or observe these other types of universes which coexist but don't exist.
Well, the word, they do exist. We don't in science prove things, right? We can't have a theoretical idea and then prove that it's right because there could be an experiment tomorrow that shows that it was wrong all along. Okay. So what we instead try to do is just to disprove ideas. It would be very easy to disprove the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics because it's just an implication of the idea that physical systems always obey this single equation, the Schrödinger equation. And it's very possible that physical systems do not always obey that equation, and that would rule out many worlds. And people are currently doing experiments trying to do exactly that. So, you know, if you don't want to believe the prediction of our best theory, that's fine, but then it's your job to come up with a better theory.
Yeah, I might get bite you on that one. Okay. So if this doesn't have a location, but we think it exists, what would disprove that theory or what would make it cemented in our mind that this is absolutely the case? Is there something that would be the killer blow for this theory that would close the book on it?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you saw that an electron just sitting there with its wave function spread out, if it suddenly spontaneously changed its wave function, so that's not what the Schrödinger equation predicts it should do. It says that it should just be able to sit there undisturbed. But if there were these spontaneous random collapses, changes of the wave function, as some other theories predict, that would mean that many worlds was not true because it would mean that the Schrödinger equation wasn't the right equation for describing what happens to systems all the time. So that's just an example. There's other examples of ways that we could imagine finding that there was a better theory than many worlds. But I mean, you're absolutely right that the worlds themselves are not viewable. And so I think that psychologically, what it would take for people to accept many worlds is just physicists like myself and others really studying the theory well enough to convince people that it does reproduce all of the successes that we see of quantum mechanics in the laboratory. And so that's what we're trying to do.
People listening to this might think that it's sort of a very egotistical idea because it sort of requires an observer to make a reality happen. And I'm wondering, is that necessarily the case when we talk about, you know, Schrödinger's experiment, where, you know, there is a cat inside of a box, the cat is both alive and dead at the same time, and we only get a result when we open the box, that gives great agency and power to the person observing. Is that the same case with quantum worlds and this many worlds idea, that there needs to be an observer for it to be real?
No, that's the great thing about it. I mean, much of the motivation for many worlds is removing the words observer from any part of the definition of quantum mechanics. Schrödinger's point with his cat, where you put the cat into a superposition of alive and dead and then open the box and it suddenly changes, was to say, surely you don't believe that. Like, this is crazy talk, right? And many physicists sort of got themselves tangled up in thinking, well, it looks like the act of observation is really central to what's going on here. How can we fit that in? And many worlds says there's nothing special about measurements or observations. There's an equation, the Schrödinger equation. That's all there ever is. And what happens is not measurement. What happens is quantum mechanical systems become entangled with the world around them, with what we call the environment. And so in Schrödinger's cat, for example, the cat becomes entangled with the environment around it long before we open the box. And it's that entanglement that branches the wave function of the universe into multiple copies. And that's when the multiple universes appear. So it has nothing to do with observers or people or consciousness or measurement. Whether or not the cat is alive or dead on our branch of the universe was decided long before we opened the box. So this question that was mysterious in conventional textbook quantum mechanics, namely, when does a measurement happen and what does it evolve, becomes crystal clear in many worlds. You just solve the Schrödinger equation, ask yourself, is the system you're thinking about entangled with the outside world, and you're done.
When you think about this from a personal level, as a human in what you believe to be one of infinite number of realities where there are infinite numbers of Sean Carrolls, does it make your head swim a little? How does it affect the idea of faith with you? Because it's one of those enormous ideas that for many is overwhelming and almost impossible to sit on top of.
Well, I do think that it is absolutely okay to recognize the mind-bendiness of this idea, okay? Like, it would be weird to sort of downplay the implications of the many-worlds approach to quantum mechanics. But, you know, different people have different attitudes toward this. You know, it's hard to come up with fundamental laws of physics. We shouldn't expect that those fundamental laws are intuitive to us. You know, when we're trying to describe the ultimate bedrock nature of reality, this isn't something we bump into in our everyday lives. So why in the world should it seem intuitive to us? So are you going to look for the simplest, most elegant and powerful rules and then hope to try to do the hard work of connecting them to your everyday reality? Or are you going to insist that those rules should just resemble your everyday reality in some obvious way? And I'm definitely on the first side of that choice.
Well, this version of Sean Carroll is the author of Something Deeply Hidden. He also wrote a romance novel in another universe. But in this one, he wrote Something Deeply Hidden. Sean Carroll, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let me know what you think of that. If you were like, oh yeah, okay, or were you like, my wife, every time my wife doesn't understand something, she just goes, 3D printing. And it's because when I first explained 3D printing to her, her head was like, mind blown. And like every time since, I say, no, really, 3D printing is not that complex. It's just printing of layers on top of each other until you get a 3D object. But it's now the phrase in our house, too complex, 3D printing.
Electricity.
It's my electricity. I'm going to be hung by that, aren't I? So, what do you make of Sean Carroll? Like, can your tiny little mind conceive of such an extraordinary expanse of infinity that encompasses infinite versions of this? And infinite versions of not this, of course. Let us know. You can email us science@newstalk.com and you can find us on Twitter. We're at @NewstalkScience. We'll talk about your theories, how you felt about that. Did you have existential dread in next week's program? Because we do our emails and tweets a week later. So I'm now going to go and do the emails and tweets and texts from last week. It gives me a week to think about a really clever response to the email. Last week, we were talking about Nobel Prizes and with great surprise, it was announced that the Nobel Prize for biology, chemistry, they were all for old men. There were three old men, for all of the prizes, right? And I said, oh, great, it's three old white men again being celebrated for their science. And part of me was thinking, look, there are obviously historical reasons why more men were in science. It is something we're changing recently. But if you're looking at some of the greatest discoveries in the history of science by scientists that are now living but did their great work 40 years ago, then it's probably unsurprising that this would happen. But we know, of course, that many of the prizes that are given out two men actually feature huge contributions from women who are mostly looked aside. The most obvious and egregious of those would be Jocelyn Bell Burnell, of course. Now, when you look at that, you say, well, should we just give it to women? And shouldn't we, merit? Isn't it a meritocracy? Isn't the best idea the one that is given the prize? And this is the theme in which I was emailed from Dominic. Dominic says, hi, there's an obsession on your show of promoting pro-diversity, pro the neoliberal agenda. I've never understood that word, neoliberal, but anyway. The reality is there's more educated white men on average than black people or women, so the likelihood of a white man getting a Nobel Prize is higher. It seems that you think the race and gender of someone is a criteria on whether or not a person should be awarded the Nobel Prize or not. Maybe the research put forward by the white men is actually better. I believe meritocracy is the only criteria for being awarded the Nobel Prize, not race or gender. How would you like, Jonathan, if you were up against an award but didn't get it because you were a white man and the Liberals wanted to award the prize to someone who isn't a white man for the sake of diversity? I'm a white man, and to constantly hear white men being criticised in the media is wearing thin at this point. This carry-on turns me off your show. I listen to your show for science, not your political point of view. So, Dominic, I have many... How much time have we got? I have many points I want to make. The first is you cannot extract culture from science. Science is a product of the culture in which it's made. And that's why I don't think I just have to talk about science. Although I generally tend to stay away from politics. My opinion seeps through everything in the programme, as does Aidan's. The things that we describe, we decide are interesting, they go on the programme, and that is through our own cultural experience of what we find interesting and what we don't. Other people will find the stuff we do really boring. The point of a meritocracy is it is extremely difficult to break out of a meritocracy if you didn't start in that meritocracy on level pegging. I saw a great tweet recently, and it was a woman who went into her boss and said, look, I think we should have a mandate of 70% women on the board, that you have to have 70% women on the board of the company. I think we should make this a mandate. And the CEO said, well, I think that's going a bit far, don't you? And she said, exactly. I'm glad you see my point of view. That's the way it's been for women for the past 15 years. So let's do something about it. And the point is, if you are someone who doesn't get advantages, who isn't seen as someone who appreciates or understands science, if you are not rewarded, if you're ignored, if you're harassed, if you are marginalized in a million different ways, to say, well, the best idea won, well, of course, white man who is just given many things to play with and rewarded for oftentimes mediocrity, of course they're going to end up by the numbers game coming up with ideas that are, if you were just to take out the culture and the history and the gender of it, could be seen as better ideas. But the way we need to change the world is to start adjusting the culture so that we end up with a more equal world. And surely you believe men and women are equal and should be equal and should be valued and should be allowed to contribute to society in their own way. So I believe that we should have mandatory gender quotas for boards, for educational conferences. I believe we should have gender quotas for the boards and companies and in government positions. And the reason I believe that is because there are a lot of smart women out there, believe it or not, Dominic, and they are very capable of doing great science. So even if we just look at within the work of chemistry, now the lithium ion battery was a pretty good idea, I'll give you that. But why consistently are we seeing just men being given these prizes? For me, I think whether it's explicit or implicit, we have to have a gender quota. And people say, well, what does that say to the first round of women who only get that prize because they are women? I take that point. However, I think and I hope that that decision will not impact the value of that award to them and it will be multiplied by millions for the women seeing that woman get the award. And the first generation of people who experience gender quotas will, of course, always question whether or not they would have got it if they were a man. But that, to me, is what's required to change the environment in which we have constantly this idea of a false meritocracy that, of course, just continues a patriarchy. So, yes, I am a neoliberal. So, anyway, look, I went on about that. But you disagree, do you?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, no, you're wrong.
Well, I think that...
No, you can't have a meritocracy if you haven't got level pegging.
No, but the fix that you're trying to make is... a fix on the wrong end. It's like, if you make a fix there, it's tokenism and it's inherently unfair.
To the first generation.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. Like, you're an individual. If you put yourself in a big group, it's like, oh, that doesn't, like, the fact that I got hard done by doesn't matter. But it does. Every individual's life matters. And when we think of each other in groups, that's when people get into problematic situations. I think the fix should be made in terms of, like, the other end. Like, not at the Nobel Prize end, but at the access to to education,
sure,
the access to,
of course, but the problem is,
funds and scholarships and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, of course, but the problem with that is it'll take generations for a society to kind of go, oh, okay, fair enough. I think that's going to take way too long. We need the change now, personally.
Yeah, cultural changes do take generations, and if you make the change immediately now, It's just like it's a band-aid. You're not making any change. It's a false change. It's like the church kind of dominated Ireland to the equal Ireland you have now with equal marriage and all those great kind of social changes. It didn't happen on the day of the marriage referendum. It happens over a very long period of time. In fact, my whole life, because I remember the early 80s and the church was still a big thing.
Yeah, look, absolutely. But that's too long. That is too long. We know there's issues. That's too long. To say, oh, it's going to take a couple of generations to fix, to me, is not good enough. And for me, for a woman to see another woman win a Nobel Prize, they start to believe that there is an opportunity there to see change. And I believe that over time, that will be a much quicker societal fix. And if you're telling me a woman wins the Nobel Prize, and thinks, oh, well, that this isn't a great prize, that this doesn't mean anything because what if I was a man? If you are recognised for that, that is a significant achievement. Is it exactly the same as winning it as in the so-called meritocracy? Maybe not. But I believe there have to be casualties, because right now there are too many casualties the other way. We have spent a lot. This is not a philosophy show. Look, Aidan's like, hands up. I'm just going to leave it there because I've said something, and now if you don't return to it, then it sounds like I'm right and you've been defeated in the argument.
No, I'm not going to return to it. I just need to say one thing. I was just going to say, I'm not going to return to it. Undoubtedly, there are women who, regardless of, like, picking a woman for picking a woman's sake, there are women who should be winning it on their own merit.
Obviously. But this is not being seen by the board. And the question is, do you tell the board that they have to recognize a difference, or do you just wait for it to come around? That's my thoughts, and I've argued this, and I've had women support this idea and women hate it idea, so it's just an opinion. Another person says, idiots talking about Nobel Prizes in science, just go away. Don't know what to do with that. It's a science program. It's probably weird if we didn't mention the sciences. And then Michael says, loving the News Talk show this morning, wide-ranging topics from genetic modification to communicating with aliens, fascinating stuff. So not everyone hates us this week. If you want to get involved in the debate we just had, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter, we're at News Talk Science. That is it. You heard far too much of producer Aidan McKelvey this week. Simon Keane was researching and on the sound was Jojo Cardoso. We'll be back with more Future Proof Gold and Extra in your podcast feed. We'll see you then. In the meantime, stay curious.